all. Good morning, Lakeview. Great to see you all here. We have had a wonderful weekend here in Saskatoon of being part of a community that is willing to reconcile, to walk together, to build trust in our journey together. Now, I don't know if you've ever had a friend like I did growing up who often started every adventure, every time we did something, whenever he called, whenever he came over to do something, it always started with, just trust me. Yeah, okay, some of you have had a friend like this. And experience always showed that he was actually not trustworthy, because the adventures always led us into shenanigans and places that I can't share on stage today. I've asked for forgiveness. But it always led me to places where it was like, oh my goodness, why did I do this? Why did I trust my friend where I know every time he says, trust me, it actually led me to places where it was very uncomfortable and not good at all. So I'm not sure if it sounds like some of you have had a friend like this. But what about, have you ever been asked or have you ever been invited to be trusted? Have you been invited to say, hey, I want to trust you with this thing or with this, you know, opportunity? Have you ever had something like that where somebody said, can I trust you with this? I'm going to offer you something and I'm trusting you will handle it well. Now, when I was 19, I was dating Jessica, my wife, and we had been dating for 2 years, and her family, my in-laws, are amazing family, great people. I think they're here today, Ron and Casey, they're somewhere, say hi to them. So, great family, and they were a skiing family. They are a skiing family. For holidays, they would go skiing, and they would generously invite this boyfriend, this stranger, this weirdo, into their family unit to go skiing with them, which Jessica was very happy about, I think, and I was very happy about. Her younger siblings might not have been. But here I was 19, we were dating for a couple of years, and I was invited to join them on their ski trip to Panorama in Alberta to go skiing. And so I was like, that's great. So we had just finished first year of Bible college, we were home. This was in the middle of the Bible college year. This was Christmas time. So they invited me on this trip. So I'm on this trip to Panorama, and we're driving, everything's going good. We're in this nice blue Astro van, you know, you remember those? Like, they were like a square brick. They were great. And so we're driving, and somewhere in the journey, Jessica's dad asks me if I would drive the rest of the way. Now, I'm not sure if this is a test or what I'm supposed to say, because A, I have never driven this van before. Like, I'm pretty comfortable driving, but here now I'm driving a family of five. I'm being trusted with people's lives to drive a vehicle that I've never driven before into the mountains where I've never been before. And it was quite unnerving to be trusted and asked into this opportunity. But I don't know if you were like me. Noah was like, well, this is the dad of my girlfriend. I have to say yes, so I'm going to do whatever he's asking. So there I was driving this van through windy roads, white knuckling the entire time, holding onto the steering wheel so tight, heartbeat at about 300. It was a moment of testing and trust that I persevered through. But it was a hard thing to be asked to be trusted and to be invited into holding people's lives while you're going on this trip. Now, we have been exploring this book of Hebrews in our series, Join In. And the clear message we have seen throughout this book is the pastor, the author of Hebrews, it reads like he's a pastor, like he's writing a sermon. He's continually inviting the church he's writing to, the church he knows, we clearly see he knows them really well, but he's also inviting us, part of his book, to look back so that he can pull us forward. And there's this continual story through the entire book of Hebrews where he's looking back to pull us forward. And what I mean by this is he's continually addressing biblical heroes, stories, ideas, movements of God in the Old Testament. That's the first half of the Bible, to demonstrate to us how God worked, how he has showed up in history, the work he has done, how he has spoken, that all of the things that God was doing in the Old Testament was actually always leading and pointing to Jesus. So he's looking back to pull us forward. And he's, in a sense, is inviting us into this pilgrimage of exploration to say, look, this is how God has spoken, right? You've seen him move like this. He showed up in this way, but that was never the end of the story. That was just the beginning. And in doing this, he implores us, the readers, and specifically his church that he's writing this sermon to, he says, join in. Stay part of this pilgrimage. Don't give up. Don't lose heart. Don't harden your hearts. Don't lose faith. And he says, build your patience. Build your trust. Build these muscles of trust in God. You see, part of his imploring is he actually knows the church really well, as I keep saying, and he doesn't want them to lose trust because he's actually seeing them. He's seeing them that they are wavering. They're not sure. And because just like the original church that has these moments of wavering and uncertainty and not sure what to do with faith in God when times gets hard, we today find ourselves having a hard time navigating faith, don't we? Don't we have a hard time navigating faith, especially when things get very difficult? When predicaments in life are hard to understand, it's like, God, where are you in this? How does this make sense? So in the past three Sundays, we asked these three questions. We said, are you listening? So if God spoke and he speaks in Jesus today, are we listening? Are we learning the language of Jesus? And then we asked, how will you rule? If God in his intended purposes have gave humanity authority to rule in Jesus, how will you rule today? Will you rule by your own rules, or will you rule in Jesus? And then last week, we asked who or what will shape your heart? And we unpacked the story that the author had, the story of Israelites leaving Egypt. And Egypt was this actual country, the strongest nation in the world at that time, but it was also a metaphor of darkness and slavery that controlled people. And they were so lost in the in-between land, in this wilderness on their way to promised land, that they were losing heart and they actually wanted to go back to slavery. Their hearts, their lives were shaped by Egypt. And so we asked the question, who or what shapes your heart? Is it Jesus or is it Egypt? Now, there's a lot to cover in our passages today. Our chapters for today is chapter 5 to chapter 7, so really encourage you to read those through our Lectio Divina practice, but as well in your home churches. There's just a lot of information and a lot of looking back at the Hebrew author pastor is doing to pull us forward. But today specifically, I'm going to root us in chapter 6, starting in verse 11, and we read the following. Our great desire is that you will keep on loving others as long as life lasts, in order to make certain that what you hope for will come true. Then you will not become spiritually dull or indifferent. Instead, you will follow the example of those who are going to inherit God's promises because of their faith and endurance. So we see the pastor outline his desire for this church that he's writing to, and he says, My desire is that you keep on loving as long as life lasts, in order to make certain what you hope for will come true. Look what he's outlining here. Our love determines what we hope for. Our love determines what we hope for. Okay, let's note that for later. And then we see this plea in him. I don't want you to become spiritually dull. I don't want you to become indifferent. Why is he saying this? Because he's likely seen people become spiritually dull and indifferent in his church. He's pastoring. He's speaking to this congregation. And again, we get a glimpse of how to do that. Like, how do we not become dull? How do we keep loving? And we get this by him looking back to pull us forward, to be faithful. So we continue to read, and he says, for example, there was God's promise to Abraham. Since there was no one greater to swear by, God took an oath in his own name, saying, I will certainly bless you, and I will multiply your descendants beyond number. And then Abraham waited patiently and received what God had promised. Now, if you are Jewish Christians in this church that the pastor is speaking to, as you read this, or as he speaks the sermon to you, you would completely know all the nuances of this conversation. Not only would you know Abraham, you would know his whole story and all the people connected to him and all the things that are going on in that narrative. It's just front brain for this group of people, for this church that he's writing to. And some of us know some of the story. We know a little bit of the Abraham story, right? Some of us that grew up in the church or Bible readers, we may know that there's a central theme that God took a man named Abram, later to be called Abraham, called him out of his country, and then sent him out to this unknown. Okay, we want to know that. He sends him out to an unknown and says, I will take you to a promised land. I will take you to your true home. I'll take you somewhere away from your mom and dad, away from your family, to a new home. But to really understand what's actually, what the original verse of Hebrews there that I just read, what it really is touching on, we really need to have more information. Information that just doesn't come from brain for us. So can I do just a little bit of Genesis 101 with you? I think it's just important for us to have that context because the author, this pastor of Hebrews, like I said, we just had assumptions that the original readers just knew exactly what this meant, okay? So I'm just gonna do a little bit of Genesis 101. So we have Genesis, which is divided into two parts. There's two sections, broadly speaking, there's two sections to this book. And section one it details the story of God and his relationship with the whole world, okay? So while the section two focuses on the story of God's relationship with Abraham and his family, okay? So section one is God and the whole world. Section two is God and Abraham and his family. So in this first section of Genesis is roughly, or not roughly, it is chapters 1 to 11. These are the chapters of section 1. And bluntly speaking, it tells a story of a spiral, downward spiral of humanity, where we see people in this first section running amok, ruining God's world. And not only ruining God's world, they're continually hurting one another. It's dark and grim passages. There's a created order, there's an intended order, which quickly is abandoned and destruction begins to enter the world. The world is destructive and the people are destructive to one another. The home is on fire. There's trouble everywhere in this section one. But then we have section two of Genesis, which starts in chapter 12 and goes right to the end of the book. And this story takes a very important turn. It is in this section we see a move. We see a response. We see the world is not as it should be. The world is on fire, metaphorically speaking. There's problems everywhere. There's people hurting one another. And God has this counter move to respond to the evil and brokenness of the world. God steps in. And it's in this second section of Genesis, we actually see that despite all the spiral, despite all the brokenness, despite all the betrayal, God offers blessing. Despite all of the evil that he sees in front of him, God begins to offer blessing and salvation to these broken humans. Are you listening? So in chapter 12, there's this encounter, as I said, between God and this man who's going to be called Abraham. And God tells him to leave his country, leave his father's family, leave their house, and to go to this land that God will show him. Go to this unknown. Just go and trust God. Go. And we read, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you and make you famous, and you'll be a blessing to others. So God says, go, trust me. And if you do, if you trust me, if you have faith in me and you do this, I will bless you. I'll make you famous. But more than that, he says, all the families on earth will be blessed through you. Go, trust me. If you trust me, I will bless you. And if you do this, the whole world will be blessed. Now, just by the repetition of words in these verses, we see a powerful moment in the story and the movement from starting chapter 12 to 50 in the book of Genesis. Humanity, in the first section, has made God its enemy. This is how it reads. Humanity turned what was good, the good creation, and chose to step outside of God's purposes for it, outside of intended order. Humanity betrays God. This is how Genesis reads. Humanity acts as the enemy to God. And what's God's response? What's God's response to humanity stepping out, acting evil, killing one another, hurting each other in creation? How does God treat his enemies here? Well, here we learn that God sets in motion a plan to bless his enemies. God's response to people's terrible actions is to bless, to forgive, to literally offer grace. And so this guy, Abraham, is going to be blessed if he trusts God. And the world, if he trusts God, the world can then receive grace. Are you listening? We get a glimpse of God's desire to be in relationship with us. So he again chooses people, just as he did in the intended order. He again chooses people as part of his larger vision so that through this people, through this family of Abraham, God's going to bring a blessing to all nations. So this is really, like, I know it's like Genesis 1:1 here, but I know it's really necessary background that we simply need to know as we re-engage with the verse of Hebrews that I started with. This is the stuff that the people who, the original church, this Jewish Christians, when they're hearing the pastor tell them this, they have this imagination. They have these sections memorized. They know the world isn't as it's supposed to be. So God blesses and offers salvation and calls out a people. This is all part of their imagination. And so we come back to the verse we started with. For example, there was God's promise to Abraham. Since there was no greater to swear by, God took an oath in his own name saying, I will certainly bless you and I will multiply your descendants beyond number. Then Abraham waited patiently and he received from God what was promised. But note the quotation within these verses. Verse 14, I will certainly bless you and I will multiply your descendants beyond number. Now, if you have your Bibles, if you had your Bible app and you're looking at this verse, you will see there's actually a footnote attached to this verse. And you would think like, oh, section 2, Genesis 12, I've learned this in church. This must be the blessing. This must be the promise. This is where the author is leading us to. But in fact, this verse actually comes from Genesis 22. Which is like, well, why would the author choose that one when the 12 one seems so good because Abraham actually trusted and he stepped out of the land. We know he kind of went on. So like, why would he go with 22 and not 12? What's happening here? Let's keep reading. Now, when people take an oath, the pastor of Hebrews writes, they call on someone greater than themselves to hold them to it. And without any question, that oath is binding. God also bound himself with an oath, so that those who received the promise could be perfectly sure that he would never change his mind. So God has given both his promise and his oath. These two things are unchangeable because it is impossible for God to lie. Therefore, we who have fled to him for refuge can have great confidence. We can trust as we hold to the hope that lies before us. But we see the pastor of Hebrews is drawing our attention here as he's bringing the imagination of Abraham, as he's bringing the story forward, and he's rooting in chapter 22. He's focusing on these promises that God makes, but more than promises, these oaths that God swore by himself. Like, there's nobody higher than God, so we can trust him. And that seems like a really nice church message, right? Trust God. He's good. He made a promise. But there seems to be more going on. What's the urgency here? Why the connection with chapter 22 and Abraham? What is actually going on behind? Yes, God makes a promise. He makes an oath. What's going on? So we see this, we see this guy's making a plea, and he says, and it seems to say, I want to suggest, that in this plea of trusting God, that even though, because he knows the original church, even though things are not going well for you, even though things are spiraling out of control, just trust God's promise. And this is where he connects it all for us. He reminds us that Abraham was, yes, led into a new land. And yes, he was promised to be a father. How else are you going to be a father of all these, of you know, the nation and be blessed and all that kind of stuff? And yet he and his wife Sarah had no children, like for a long time. Like they're like in their 70s and there's still nothing happening. They're in their 90s and nothing's happening. Like they're super old. When will actually God come through? Can he? And then although Hebrews shows Abraham is very patient, he actually isn't. Abraham becomes impatient and Sarah becomes impatient. And they're like, we have no children. We can't understand, how will God provide? How will we be this great nation if we don't have kids? And so they actually lose trust. So much so that Sarah says, hey, we have a servant girl, Hagar. Abraham, you know, go sleep with her. We'll orchestrate, we'll perform. We will bring God's promise to completion. We will achieve what we know is from God. We're trusting, we're waiting, but it's taking too long. We will do this. We will do this. And of course, their actions creates more pain, more hurt, which then explains why the author jumps into Genesis 22 and not 12, where he says, I will certainly bless you and multiply your descendants beyond number. You see, in chapter 12, there's a promise and they follow it, but in chapter 22, the promises actually come to fruition. But chapter 22 is an incredibly difficult chapter. What we find in this chapter is that God has now blessed Abraham and Sarah. They finally, finally have a child, Isaac. And it happens literally in the chapter before 22. Literally, one chapter before, chapter 21, my math is accurate here. One chapter, 21, they have a child. Chapter 22, God tests Abraham and asks him to sacrifice his son. What? Wait a minute. Why would God do this? They waited. Yes, they messed up. They did their things on their own. But now God has finally blessed them. God is true to his promises. God, they don't come through, but God comes through. They have a child. Sacrifice him. Is God that vindictive? Is God vindictive? Can he be trusted? How could he ask this of Abraham? Why even have Isaac be born into this cruel world if that's his fate? But yet Genesis reads, chapter 22, that God tests Abraham to perform the worst violent act possible, sacrificing a child. So a couple of things. We'll just pause here for a second, but a couple of things. What we would, if we looked at this chapter as anthropologists, what we would see is that people in Canaan at that time, Abraham's neighbors and society around him, the Canaanites practiced child sacrifice all the time. Like it was just in the air, it was milieu. Like we want something accomplished, we're gonna do this. It's done all the time around Abraham to appease the gods, to achieve, to perform, to do something great, so that if we do something great, then if the sacrifice is just so big, then we'll get what we want. And it's horrific. It's horrific, but it's just part of the ancient world fabric that describes to us the first section. This is exactly how dark and spiraling the world has become, that this practice is common. And it was a way to understand gods and the chaotic things around us, that if I just do this great thing, if I just achieve this amazing sacrifice, like sacrificing a child, then God will do what I need him to do. Now, if you're feeling uncomfortable, good, you should be. This is awful. But it's an important thing for us to look at anthropologically into that time and era to understand that this is actually something that's happening. Secondly, the confusing part of this request is in fact that throughout the entire scriptures, God keeps saying he detests this kind of practice, that he's against child sacrifice, that he's opposed to this ritual. We see it over and over and over. The God says, I'm against it. I despise it. I hate it. So why is he asking it? And thirdly, how will God's promise come to fruition if Abraham and Sarah finally have a child and now he's being sacrificed? We read again. So God has given both his promise and his oath. These two things are unchangeable because it is impossible for God to lie. Therefore, we who have fled to him for refuge can have great confidence. We can trust as we hold to the hope that lies before us. The pastor of Hebrews is reminding us to trust God's promises. God is tested with trust. He's being tested with his faith. Now, he has responded poorly in times. We know that in Abraham's story. If we were to read it, you would know it. And the people, the original church that read this knew this, that he actually failed a bunch of times. But here in this passage, it seems to read that God, that Abraham shows deep trust and obedience. But can I suggest an obedience that's actually familiar to his culture? Maybe even trying, he's tying this notion to the Canaanites. If I do this great thing God is asking me, then God will do great things. Maybe he'll resurrect Isaac. The author of Hebrews, the pastor, is pulling us into these confusing threads to say, do you trust? Do you trust that God will come through, not in the way the world around you promises, where you achieve something, where you perform, where you do a great task, or rather, do you trust that God will bless, that God will do what he says he will do, even when all the good is spiraling out of control? Do you believe that in the midst of disaster, in the midst of pain, in the midst of sickness, in the midst of death, in the midst of life's storms, that God actually still wants to bless you and keep his promises? You see, the pastor of Hebrews is saying, you are seeing persecution. He's saying this to the early church that he's writing to. You're seeing hard times. You're facing persecution. You're not making, that your faith does not make sense in light of what you're observing in this time. It's not working out the way you want it to work out. You are tempted to do something great. So you're saying, okay, it's not working out, so I'm tempted then to step in and take the reins into my own hands and accomplish the will of God because it's just going too slow. And the author says, have you developed patience and trust? Do you, Paul, do you trust that God is good and that he will provide? Paul, do you trust that God is good even though you see wars and violence, mistrust everywhere? Do you believe that despite what you see, despite of you, that God is good and he will provide? This is what the author's tugging on here. He's saying, do you trust that God will come through? Will you be patient enough? And will you trust that God will provide when the world seems to be falling apart around you? Or will you take the reins? Will you orchestrate and perform and do something great and incredible, even an act of sacrifice to move God to act? I think there's a tension here that exists in these passages. It is a test, but it's a certain kind of test, a test of faith. Will God act like all the other gods of Canaan, or is he different? Can he be trusted? And then he says, this hope, this trust, this hope in God is a strong and trustworthy anchor for our souls. It leads us through the curtain into God's inner sanctuary. Author's playing out all these things back to Abraham and all this test and trust. Do you trust that God will actually come through? Do you trust that he will bless you? Do you trust that he will not act like the world? And he says, God is actually a trustworthy anchor for our soul. And he uses anchor here. What an interesting word. Anchor. Now, do you know what anchor is in biblical Greek? It's anchor. I thought it was funny. Nobody laughed. All right. It's a little heavy topic, I guess, but yeah, it's anchor. And anchor is also one of the, just a side note, anchor is also actually one of those first Christian symbols. You know, sometimes those of us may know the fish is a symbol for the early church communities. Anchor was actually one of the early church symbols that the church used. And it's an important symbol and metaphor, even though it appears only a couple times in the New Testament. And the pastor tells us that in the midst of all uncertainty, in the midst of all the things like, where are you, God? Can I trust you? I'm impatient. What do I do? He tells us that God is an anchor. Now, what is an anchor? What does the anchor do? Now, we know it's anchor in Greek, but what does it do? Does it prevent storms? Does it guarantee smooth rides? Does it keep us from horrible situations and moments in life that are so hard and difficult? Does it prevent best laid plans from spiraling out of control? No, the anchor doesn't do that. But what the anchor does is it literally keeps us steady. It secures us in the midst of a storm. It provides us safety and hope that we won't go adrift. It keeps us anchored in the turbulent and stormy seasons of life. Are you listening? The pastor reminds us that faith requires patience and trust. And he looks backwards to pull us forward, that Abraham was promised great blessing and took many, many years. And he tried to intervene on his own and he failed. And God still blessed him because God is true to his promises, even when we are not. God comes through. He doesn't take away the storms. He doesn't take away the pain, the trials. Remember last week we talked about we're in the in-between land between Egypt and the promised land. We're like in this desert. He doesn't take those away. But what he does do is give us himself, the anchor in the midst of the storm. He gives us himself so we can anchor ourselves and endure the storms. Not just survive the storms through our own strength, through our own wisdom or brilliance or our own abilities. Not to perform miraculously or incredibly in storms, but just to instead trust. Trust that God, who is the anchor in the storm, will provide what he promised to provide. And then the author points and pulls us to Jesus, to the one who is faithful to the promises. He looked back at Abraham. He showed us how God was faithful to him. He showed us that despite the test of faith, that God provided a way out, provided something different, that he didn't act like the Canaanite gods, that he put an end to child sacrifice in the moment. And he points to Jesus, the one who enters our presence, who comes into this world, God who comes into this world, so that we can step into the inner sanctuaries. This is the image of the temple. Inner sanctuaries where God's presence was. So Jesus steps into our presence then, this is the promise, and allows us to step into the presence of God. In Jesus, we are in the presence of God. In Jesus, we can enter home. In Jesus, when we await and trust, in Jesus, we're able to enter the presence of God. So the pastor to Hebrews is pleading with his church. And he's telling us as well, trust. I know life is not the way you wish it was. I know you wouldn't do it this way. I know you would have done it a different way. I know you would interfere in a way that things are going and say, no, this way. I want to intervene and do differently. But he says, just trust. Trust that God will deliver on his promises. He has sworn himself. There's no one higher he can swear by. He's made an oath by himself. And if he's made that oath, he will make the promise come to completion. So just trust. Build those trust muscles. Because God responds and provides as you have seen him do for Abraham and Sarah. Dr. James Finley said it this way. If we are absolutely grounded, and I'm forcing the word anchored. If we are absolutely anchored in the absolute love of God that protects us from nothing. Let me read that again. If we are absolutely anchored in the absolute love of God that protects us from nothing, even as it sustains us in all things, then we can face all things with the courage and tenderness and touch the hurting places in others and in ourselves with love. Remember how the author of Hebrews started for us, right? Verse 11, our great desire is that you will keep on loving others as long as life lasts in order to make certain that what you hope for will come true. When we learn to trust, we learn to love. When we learn to love, we learn to be sustained in all things, even when we're protected from nothing. So the question for us this week is, will you trust that God will provide? Will you trust that God will provide in the midst of all the turbulence, in the midst of all the storms, in the midst of all uncertainty? Will you trust that God will not lie, that he will provide what he has promised? Friends, and this is not a simple question. These are difficult words. There's very real pain attached to this trust. I know that. I know some of your journeys. I know my own journey. There's pain attached to this question. And as you ponder this in light of your reality, As you ponder, as you think, will you trust? I'm just going to invite those that are helping out with communion to come and take their stations. And as you ponder this reality, as you ponder if you could trust, can I just remind you that God who promised in Jesus came into this world, and on the night he was betrayed, we read this, on the night he was betrayed, on the night others lost trust in him, on the night where things began to spiral out, it was in that night he took the bread and he broke it, saying, "This, take this and eat it. This is my body." And then he took the cup of wine and gave thanks to God for it. He gave it to them and said, "Each of you drink from it, for this is my blood." This confirms the covenant, the promise between God and his people. It is poured out as a sacrifice to forgive the sins of many.